The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
In America, a mosquito bite usually means nothing more than an irritating itch. But in Africa, it can be the kiss of death.
Public enemy number one, Anopheles, the malaria mosquito. Wanted for bringing sickness and misery to untold millions in many parts of the world.
Malaria kills one child every 30 seconds, but hope is on the way. In Mali, puppets teach people to use bed nets. Gabon is about to try a new malaria vaccine. And in Thailand, there's the electric racket zapper.
So when a mosquito gets close, you swing and zap it. Words cannot describe the satisfaction.
Conquering a killer. Get the buzz on it here on the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Every 30 seconds, a child dies from malaria. That's a shocking statistic, and it's one the World Health Organization wants to cut dramatically. The WHO's goal is to eradicate malaria completely by 2015. The group is working with many partners in the fight against malaria.
For example, there's more money put into baldness drugs than are put into malaria. Now, baldness, it's a terrible thing. And rich men are afflicted.
That's Bill Gates, so speaking a few months ago at a conference of technology gurus, film directors, musicians, some of the top creative people in the country. He goes on to say that despite his own thinning hair, fighting malaria should be a much higher priority than developing baldness drugs. The Gates Foundation has poured $1.4 billion into the effort to fight malaria.
Even the million deaths a year caused by malaria greatly understate its impact. Over 200 million people at any one time are suffering from it. It means that you can't get the economies in these areas going because it holds things back so much.
Here's where it gets interesting.
Now, malaria is, of course, transmitted by mosquitoes. I brought some here.
By here, he means into the auditorium, up there on stage, under a glass jar.
So you could experience this.
And then he picks up that glass top.
We'll let those roam around the auditorium a little bit.
And he sets them free. Okay. Listen to that nervous laughter. But don't worry.
Those mosquitoes are not infected.
Rumor has it audience members weren't actually all that amused. As Bill Gates so vividly points out, when it comes to malaria, the first thing we think about is mosquitoes. So that's where we thought we'd begin this hour, finding out exactly how the little mosquito causes such a huge public health problem. We sent reporter Cynthia Graber to investigate.
Let's start off with the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about mosquitoes.
Blood.
Mosquito bites.
I think about specifically about blood. I think about this time I was traveling with a friend who every morning we would wake up in our whatever hostel we were in, and her sheets would have blood splatters on them because in her sleep she had been like swatting at mosquitoes.
When a mosquito bites you, and if you hit it right at the right moment, then the blood spurts like all over and kind of explodes.
Yikes.
And how many species of mosquitoes do you think there are?
23.
Like a couple hundred?
Correct answer, thousands.
And none of them bite me.
They all bite me.
Okay, now time for the advanced quiz. Do you know which sex of mosquito does the biting?
Yeah, I feel like there's something that I heard once about girl mosquitoes versus boy mosquitoes, and there's some difference in whether or not they can bite you or hurt you, but I might be making that up.
In fact, only females bite us. Males drink plant nectar. Females do too, but they need protein from blood for their developing eggs. If it were me, I'd think blood is blood. Any blood will do. But different mosquitoes have different tastes. Some just love humans. Unfortunately, one type of mosquito that loves us the most is the one that carries the malaria parasite.
Anopheles, the malaria mosquito.
Now, we usually blame malaria on the poor old mosquito. But in fact, the mosquito is just an unwitting dupe of the malaria parasite. More on that in a bit. I wanted to learn more about the Anopheles mosquito, so I headed to the Malaria Research Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And there, I met up with a scientist named George Demopoulos. He works on the mosquito immune system, Yes, they do have immune systems.
Okay, so in this room, we actually maintain different mosquito species.
We're in the Johns Hopkins Insectarium. They breed mosquitoes for research. The hum you hear is from a humidifier. Mosquitoes need humidity. If it's too dry, they simply shrivel up. There are about a dozen cages here, and each one has 200 to 300 mosquitoes in it. The cages are draped with nets.
This is not an Anopheles mosquito. You can see this is a larger and darker mosquito. It's Aedes aegypti that can transmit dengue virus.
Can you see the difference between an Aedes aegypti and an Anopheles?
Absolutely, yeah. Aedes aegypti is a larger and darker mosquito. It also looks different, has a slightly different shape, the way it sits on the cage.
And here come the Anopheles mosquitoes.
These are now Anopheles mosquitoes. You can see they're smaller than those, and they're not as dark.
Wow, they're going nuts in there.
Yeah, they are going really nuts in here. They are flying around like crazy. Now I've placed my hand. You see how I placed my hand there?
He puts his hand on top of the cage over the netting.
You see all the mosquitoes that are sitting on my hand?
They zoom up to the fabric.
And I can actually start to feel them, how they start to bite. They can bite me through the net. But these mosquitoes are not infected with anything, so there is no danger.
They can smell him, and they sense blood. Different species of the Anopheles mosquito live around the world, everywhere but Antarctica, as a matter of fact. But the ones in Africa are the most skilled at transmitting malaria to us. Maybe that's because we evolved in Africa, along with those pesky mosquitoes and the malaria parasite. So let's go through the life cycle of an Anopheles mosquito. To get a sense of how humans contract malaria, I asked George Demopoulos to play a little game.
I'm a pupae. I'm in the water at the breeding site.
We'll just pretend pupae can talk. And he's in the water because mosquitoes need standing water to breed.
I emerge now as an adult female. It may be nighttime and I will fly. I will go and sit under a leaf somewhere.
That sounds nice.
Later on, I will try to find a nectar meal, a sugar meal. I need sugar energy. So I'll probably be able to smell myself to some plant that has nectar. I take a sugar meal. And then I may want to mate. During nighttime, I will start to feel hungry. Not because I need it for energy to fly or live, but because I need to lay eggs. And to lay eggs, I need a blood meal. So I will start to smell and try to find a human, because I have been adapted to smell and feed on humans.
We're easy targets. We live in groups, and we often congregate close to water. So the mosquito picks up a human scent in the air and starts flying.
And eventually I'll reach a small village. And there will be some huts there, and I will fly into a hut. And now the smells will be very strong. I can also feel the carbon dioxide and the heat even from these humans in there. And I will land on someone's skin, and I will start to probe.
She finds a blood vessel and drills into the skin with her thin proboscis. Next, she injects some saliva into the wound to keep the blood flowing. Mosquito saliva contains an anticoagulant. But there's a surprise for her in the blood.
Now, what is happening inside me is that I've actually taken up a malaria parasite from this human.
So we give the malaria parasite to the mosquito.
Mosquitoes have an immune system similarly to humans, which they use to fight off infections. And in many mosquito species, their immune system will actually kill all the malaria parasites.
But some species of Anopheles don't manage to kill off all the malaria parasites. A few slip by and travel through the mosquito until they reach the saliva. And here's where, once again, Anopheles are special. Now, stay with me. I know it sounds a little complicated, but it's all going to get clear in a minute. Not all mosquitoes that feed on humans take two blood meals in their lifetimes. This is important because in order to transmit malaria from one person to another, the mosquito has to catch malaria from one human and then give it to another. Anopheles snack on humans for the second time about a week and a half after the first meal. That's just enough time for the malaria parasite to reach the mosquito saliva.
So I will again repeat the process which I did previously. I will fly into a hut. I will sense a human. I will sit on the skin.
Now, when the mosquito sprays her saliva into the puncture wound she's just made, that saliva contains the malaria parasite. And for the person who's just been bitten, it could be deadly.
That was the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber. You can see video of Bill Gates and the mosquitoes on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Thanks to Johns Hopkins researcher George Demopoulos for pretending to be a mosquito. And thanks to Rachel Bragan and Adam Birkin for gamely showing off their mosquito knowledge, or lack thereof. The United States was declared free of malaria in 1949. That's just 60 years ago. Before that, malaria was a real public health problem. Even Charles Dickens wrote about the pale and tired people he saw when he visited here in the 1840s. Duke University historian Margaret Humphreys explains how the disease got here in the first place.
It appears that malaria came in two ways. And first of all, realize there's two kinds of malaria. There's the milder vivax malaria and the more severe falciparum malaria. Vivax came in the bodies of Europeans. There was malaria in England, in Holland, in France, in Spain, in Italy. And settlers who came to the United States from those areas brought it with them because vivax is an organism that can kind of hide out for a while and then come back out when times are looking better. Falciparum malaria came mostly in the bodies of Africans who were brought mostly against their will. And falciparum is a disease of the warmer areas. So falciparum wasn't much north, say, of the North Carolina north border. It was a disease of South Carolina, Georgia, the Mississippi Delta. Whereas vivax, the one that came with the Europeans, was the one that was all over the north as well as in the south.
Was malaria a serious threat?
One of the things malaria does is it interferes with the placental blood supply, namely that connection between the mother and the fetus. So one thing that malaria does is cause miscarriages and stillbirths. Vivax malaria makes people thoroughly miserable, doesn't kill that many. Some estimates are about 5% of people who get it, but it knocks you down. It keeps you from working. You don't plow your fields and you don't milk the cow because you feel too lousy. Falciparum malaria kills, and there's a lot of variables into, you know, what your chances are once you get it. But in someone who has no prior immunities, probably your chance of dying from falciparum malaria, 25-35%. So it was a significant killer.
Margaret Humphreys studies the history of disease at Duke University. She says that in some parts of the U.S., malaria declined almost by accident. People settled on higher, drier land. And as they became more prosperous, they put screens on their doors and windows. By 1900, malaria was found mainly in the poor rural South. A campaign to wipe out the disease altogether started in 1947. Swamps were drained and houses were sprayed with DDT. Within 2 years, the disease was history. RTSS might sound like something out of Star Wars, but it's really the name of a promising malaria vaccine. It's about to start its final trial in Africa. We'll hear the latest news on that after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Malaria has been around for thousands of years. Alexander the Great supposedly died from it. Egyptian mummies have shown signs of it. We know that both George Washington and Abraham Lincoln suffered from it. So, with all the technology at our disposal, why haven't we been able to stop the disease once and for all, like we did here in the U.S.? Well, there are lots of reasons. Lack of money, lack of will, lack of infrastructure. But all of that is changing. We'll have more on that later. Right now, we want to tell you the big news about a new vaccine. Researchers have been looking for a malaria vaccine for 70 years. The new RTSS vaccine has shown real promise in early testing, and the final phase of the trial is about to begin across Africa. Megan Williams traveled to Gabon for the official launch.
Joe Cohen shakes hands with 23-year-old Chansia Andia Amoko. The 65-year-old's bearded face crinkles into a broad, emotional smile. As head biologist at GlaxoSmithKline in Brussels, Cohen has worked for the past 25 years on developing the malaria vaccine. today in a small village outside Lamborghini. He's here to thank Imoco for allowing her baby to participate in the study. It's an unusual trip for such a senior researcher, but this is a groundbreaking vaccine. Cohen explains it fights the parasite in the early stage of infection with a 1-2 punch.
It works by inducing immune defenses of two types. Antibodies that attack the parasite while it's swimming in the blood, and T cells that attack the parasites after it enters the liver and can recognize liver cells that are infected with the parasite and destroy them. So these two mechanisms, we believe, are at the basis of the success of RTS.
RTSS is the technical name for the vaccine. It's shown real promise in previous smaller studies. In the most recent one, the incidence of malaria in children who received the vaccine was cut by more than half compared to those who weren't vaccinated. Now the study's about to head into its final stretch, a massive Pan-African trial involving 16,000 kids in 11 different sub-Saharan sites. Dr. Maxine Agnaji is another member of the international research team. He works for the medical research unit of the Albert Schweitzer Hospital in Lamborghini and grew up in Gabon. He's heading up the vaccine trial here. Agnaji sits down with Imoco, the woman Joe Cohen just thanked. He goes over the consent form with her. Before Imoco agreed to have her daughter be part of the RTSS trial, she attended several public information sessions in her village. Then, she says, she carefully went over the consent form with Agnaji. Even today, weeks after she signed the form, she has more questions. Imoco's daughter will be in one of three groups. One that gets the malaria vaccine alone, or another group that gets the malaria vaccine as well as a vaccine against meningitis, or in the third group, known as the control group, which will be used for comparison. That group receives a rabies vaccine. Which children are in which group is confidential. So Imoco asks Dr. Agnaji, if her daughter is bitten by an animal, how will doctors know whether or not she's been vaccinated against rabies? Agnaci tells her it's an excellent question. And in that case, doctors make an exception and check which group the child is in. Agnaci says just like proper follow-up, informed consent, in which a participant understands all the risks and benefits of the vaccine, is a slow but crucial process.
We have to explain everything to the mothers. We have to make the scientific information accessible for the parent. Those who cannot understand the scientific information, we have to find a way to explain things to them. For me, I'm very excited to do that kind of work with the community, and I learn a lot of from them also.
Despite the fact that the consent process for the vaccine meets strict American standards, pharmaceutical testing makes people here suspicious. That's because the history of Western drug testing in Africa is checkered. For instance, the Nigerian government and the U.S. drug company Pfizer recently agreed to settle a multi-million dollar lawsuit out of court. Nigeria accused Pfizer of testing an antibiotic on sick children without parental consent. 11 kids in the 1996 study died, and almost 200 were injured. Despite the settlement, Pfizer denies any wrongdoing. Imoco herself has heard people disparage this vaccine study.
Some people here speak badly about this study. They say the researchers are using kids as guinea pigs, that they're using the children's blood for other things, not for a study on malaria. But I read the consent form, and these people didn't. These people don't ask any questions like I did to Dr. Maxine. For me, it's clear. I don't have any doubts.
But others still do, like the Gabonese Minister of Health. The final phase of the vaccine trial was supposed to officially launch in Africa this week. Then, at the 11th hour, the health minister suddenly announced he wanted more time to study the proposal and postpone the launch. It was a huge blow to Cohen and the others, but they insist they're optimistic the trial will start soon. Mothers like Amoko are just as keen to get going. Vaccine aside, she says, the study provides other appealing benefits.
A big advantage of being in this study is that if my child gets sick or gets hurt, they give you free medical treatment. That helps us a lot because we can't afford it otherwise.
If the results of the previous field trials are confirmed in this larger one, GlaxoSmithKline will submit the vaccine for regulatory approval. That's about 3 years away. Then the challenge will be making the vaccine affordable to the people who need it most. Joe Cohen insists that's a priority for all involved.
It makes sense. You know, this malaria vaccine, in contrast to many other vaccines, is exclusively meant for African children. There is no other market for it. It would be crazy for us, after 25 years of work on malaria vaccine, to do anything that would prevent this vaccine from being accessible when it's available and to see this vaccine just sitting on a shelf.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Megan Williams in Lamborghini, Gabon.
Mosquitoes are pests wherever you come across them. Luckily for reporter Patrick Nguyen, the mosquitoes in Bangkok, where he's based, don't carry malaria. Those mosquitoes are found much farther away in rural parts of Thailand. But all across the country, people have found an innovative, low-tech way to keep any mosquito at bay. Here's Patrick's commentary.
Summer in Thailand is a hellish, humid, hot season. For me and my fellow mammals, it can be kind of a bummer. But for our two-winged, puddle-dwelling, blood-sucking nemesis, the mosquitoes, life is good. Mosquitoes are a fact of life in Bangkok, a tropical metropolis built on a swamp. Up until last century, Thais navigated the city through Venetian-style canals. But now, in the age of taxis and traffic jams, those canals are thick with sewage, trash, and hordes of mosquitoes. Still, as the bloodsuckers mount their hot season assault, I know Thailand will not take the surge laying down. That's the sound of a mosquito zapper. This device is essentially a plastic racket with metallic netting. You charge it overnight, press a button on the handle, and electricity surges through the racket. So when a mosquito gets close, you swing and
zap it. Then you get to watch it crackle and burn in little bursts of blue sparks. The air will smell of death. Words cannot describe the satisfaction, and clearly some inventor was cheated out of a Nobel Prize. The zapper is sold on countless street corners here. When I first bought one and brought it home, I treated it like a plutonium warhead. I was pretty sure I would shock myself into a coma, or at least catch the curtains on fire. But I soon realized the current was only strong enough to kill insects, and that I could freely poke the netting to make painless little sparks. See? Doesn't hurt at all, unless you're a mosquito. These days, I keep my racket within reach at all times. If I'm in bed and feel the slightest tingle on my arm hairs, a possible mosquito attack, I will rub the racket on my skin like a cheese grater. And after months of swatting, dozens of dead mosquitoes are still clinging to the racket's metal wiring. Turn it on in a dark room and the fried mosquito bits will glow translucent blue. Again, very satisfying. In Thailand, the mosquito zapper truly crosses class lines. From Bangkok high society to rice farmers without indoor plumbing, most everyone owns a zapper, which usually sell for about $7 or $8. Realistically, with mosquitoes breeding in every open sewer and filthy canal in Bangkok, there's no way to win the war. So yes, fighting back is futile, but at least with the racket zapper, it's a blast.
Patrick Nguyen is a correspondent for Global Post. He's based in Thailand. And you can see pictures of the racket zappers on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Yep, you're right. It's the theme from American Idol. And what, you ask, is American Idol doing on a public radio show about malaria? Well, the TV talent show has raised $29 million to fight malaria through its Idol Gives Back program. American Idol finalist Melinda Doolittle wowed audiences during one of the special broadcasts. She joins me now to talk about her work with malaria. Thanks so much for being here, Melinda.
Thank you for having me.
Melinda, you were one of the finalists on American Idol, and you're not only a successful singer, but you've become involved with the nonprofit group called Malaria No More. how did you come to care so strongly about malaria?
I first learned about malaria during Idol Gives Back. The day before the show aired, they took us back into the offices, and Nigel Lithgow showed us videos of what they were going to show on Idol that next day. And we started looking at these videos, and there was not a dry eye in there, because we noticed that children were dying, and children under the age of 5, they need people that are looking out for them. And to see that a million of them die every year from malaria blew my mind. And that a bed net cost $10 and 3 children, you know, could fit under a bed net. And I was like, that is so easy.
And then you were invited to go to Africa, to Zambia. Tell me a little bit about that trip.
I don't think I had any idea what to expect exactly. And I get there and I start to meet these little children, you know, the same children that are at risk for this disease. In the midst of all of this poverty, they don't have the money to do anything to provide their own bed nets, but they were the most joyful children I had ever met in my life. I ended up getting to sing with a choir of some of those children who they learned English just to sing Amazing Grace with me. So once I got done crying uncontrollably, we were able to sing together and just have an amazing time of people coming together, trying to figure out how we can make this happen quickly, how we can prevent malaria quickly, how we can eradicate it.
You have a new album out. It just came out in February. It's called Coming Back to You. And I understand part of the proceeds are going to purchase bed nets for African children. Is that right?
Yes, I just released my debut album, Coming Back to You, and I was so excited to be able to support Malaria No More and just help them continue to raise awareness.
Melinda, I hope this doesn't seem presumptuous, but I do have to ask. You mentioned a little while ago that the children in Zambia actually learned how to sing Amazing Grace in English so they could perform it for you. How would you feel about singing a few lines of that for us?
Oh, gosh. I will try for you. Not very warmed up, but I'll definitely try for you. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Melinda Doolittle's new album is called Coming Back to You.
Now I'm found, was blind, but now I see.
Insecticide-treated bed nets are an effective way to fight malaria, but many people who need them can't afford them. So in 2004, the World Health Organization paid for a project that handed out bed nets in a small village in northern Tanzania. By last year, the number of malaria cases in that village had been cut in half, Richard Locke reports.
In an overcrowded hospital ward near the town of Arusha, a woman wails deliriously. On a nearby bed, 36-year-old Amina Ngoi lies still, attached to a quinine drip.
I was admitted yesterday with malaria. I had a nasty headache, backache, and my waist was feeling very tight.
She'd brought her 4-year-old son to the same hospital just 2 days earlier. He too had malaria.
He was in very bad shape, acting like a madman and speaking incoherently. Now he is recovering.
15 miles to the east, in the shadow of Mount Miro's sheer slopes, muddy waters flow along an irrigation channel. Beyond the stream, women stoop low in the verdant paddy fields, pulling out weeds from among the rice plants. In the soft light of late afternoon, the scene is idyllic. But these waterlogged paddies host killers, malaria-carrying mosquitoes. Not far away, Judy Nico walks through her maize field, the other staple crop here, in the village of Usa. Her sleeping baby daughter is strapped to the 26-year-old's back.
The paddies, they are really swampy. It's always damp because the rice requires a lot of water, and this is where the mosquitoes breed. And this area, when it gets dark, between 6 and 7, the mosquitoes are just too many.
Nico remembers a time when she would be struck down with malaria 3 or 4 times in a year, but no more. That's because 5 years ago, each household received insecticide nets to cover each bed and every window. They're made in a nearby factory, the only one in Africa to produce this type of net, which remains effective for up to 7 years. 48-year-old Nima Gunda sits on her dirt porch, chatting with her neighbour, as the two strip corn kernels off their husks. Then Gunda leads the way indoors, pushing aside some coarse blue netting.
You can see these are curtains, but they are made of mosquito nets. So when the sun sets, I have to spread it all over the window so that the whole window is covered. That way, mosquitoes don't come into the house.
And there are nets for each of the 3 beds in the house.
The ones we used to use were light and would tear very easily. If you touch this one, you'll see how durable it is.
Gunda's old nets used to need respraying with insecticide every few months. Otherwise, they were useless. But the active ingredient in these nets is embedded in the fibres. Villagers say the incidence of malaria in Usa has dropped dramatically since the factory distributed nets here as part of a project supported by the World Health Organization. But at $5 a piece, these nets remain too expensive for many of Africa's poor to consider buying. In her backyard, Judy Nico has returned from her maize field to wash the dishes with her daughter. She too received the free nets and religiously ensures her toddler daughter is safely tucked under one each night. Nico says she understands the importance of nets, but would she buy them?
You see, the cost of bringing up a kid has become so expensive these days. I have the milk bill, I have diapers and other things to go with. With the net, I don't know. I don't know where it would come on my list of priorities.
The reality is that for many of Africa's poor, $5 is simply out of reach. The United Nations hopes to reduce the incidence of malaria by 2015. To do so, it will need to persuade donors that $5 a net is a small price to pay, not just for a single village, but an entire continent. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Usa, northern Tanzania.
The islands of Zanzibar are a tourist dream. Think clear blue waters and clean white sand. The same islands could also be key to wiping out malaria on the African continent. We'll tell you how after a short break. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. The islands of Zanzibar in the Indian Ocean look as exotic as they sound. They were originally famous for their spices. But these days, Zanzibar, which is part of Tanzania, is known for something else, its success in controlling malaria. Mark Green was formerly the U.S. ambassador to Tanzania. He now directs the Malaria Policy Center for a group called Malaria No More.
One of the reasons why you focus on the islands of Zanzibar, or islands at all, is because they sort of serve as a laboratory. You can prove that these programs work, take the lessons learned and apply them to a larger stage. 3 large tools. It's residual indoor spraying, which is largely spraying the walls inside people's homes. Bed net coverage, making sure that you basically had a bed net for every couple of people in those homes. And then access to drugs, artemisinin and combination therapy being the state of the art. And went to the islands, sprayed a couple of times, made sure the nets were there, and that's how we saw the success that we've seen. And it's encouraging because, it tells us, it proves to us that this works, that we can conquer malaria deaths, and allows us to take those lessons to the mainland.
How well did it work? Can you tell us when the project started and what the rate of malaria was at the beginning and at the end?
Well, several years ago, the malaria infection rate was certainly, well above 35%. The last numbers I saw, that's down below 1%.
Yes, that's amazing. And I understand the government of Tanzania wants to expand the lessons they've learned from Zanzibar to the rest of the country. How is that going?
The startup of the project has been taking some time because you really have to get in place all of the key pieces. In a country like Tanzania, you have real challenges of distribution because of the infrastructure. Getting to the remote regions where malaria may be particularly endemic is oftentimes a challenge. You have to get those bed nets out there. But there's another part to it that we're working on, particularly Malaria No More, the organization that I'm helping to lead, and that's what we call demand creation. In many areas, well, many areas in the world, there isn't a tradition of bed nets.
We hear stories sometimes about people using bed nets for everything but keeping mosquitoes off the bed. For one, I hear it can be very hot and uncomfortable under the nets. Do you actually come across this problem?
You know, I hear that. I've got to say that when I was ambassador, I didn't see a lot of that. I mean, I would hear stories occasionally, but, you know, again, I think it all comes back to creating the habit of utilizing bed nets. We mustn't assume that everybody understands in Africa what malaria is, how it's fought, and the fact that it can be fought. I taught school in Kenya 20-plus years ago in a small village. And in my village, my students believe that you got malaria from rain. And you can understand how people would jump to that conclusion. After all, for hundreds of years, we in the West thought you got malaria from bad air, which is what malaria literally means, translated. And so you have to also reach out with a public awareness campaign, letting people know, A, you don't have to live with malaria, B, that malaria is preventable and fully treatable. And so you have to get out there with that. And then, of course, you have to go a step further and help people to understand what these tools are, why these tools work. And I would say, finally, one more step, you have to create role models. It's important that we have buy-in from the Tanzanian government leadership so that when they go to their home areas and when they go to their church or their mosque, they will say to people, yes, I use a bed net because this is what works. Yes, I have had my home sprayed because we know that this works. Fighting malaria is attainable. This is achievable, verifiable, measurable. This is something we can do. The UN Secretary General has talked about universal bed net coverage across Africa by the end of 2010 and ending malaria deaths by 2015. I'm convinced that we can get there and really have the first great humanitarian victory of the 21st century.
Mark Green with Malaria No More, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Green is the director of the Malaria Policy Center, based in Washington, D.C. The islands of Zanzibar are doing well, but just across the water on the mainland of Tanzania, malaria infection rates remain high. As we just heard from Mark Green, the disease is pretty easy to treat with the right drugs, and the right drugs are available. But there's a problem, and it's getting bigger every day. Gretchen Wilson reports from Dar es Salaam.
This is a hole-in-the-wall pharmacy at the Kariakoo Market. It's crowded, and boxes of medicines are stacked from floor to ceiling. At the counter, pharmacist George Frank points to boxes of a brand-name medicine to treat malaria.
This is a combination of two drugs, artemether and lumefantrine. We always use for malaria nowadays.
You don't need a prescription to get this drug. Treatment costs just $1. Take the pills and you should be cured.
4 morning, 4 evening, for 3 days.
This pharmacist insists these drugs are real. But in Tanzania and the rest of the developing world, imitation pharmaceuticals, including anti-malarial drugs, are being sold to unwitting consumers at markets like this one.
I know, we don't know fake one, because we have pharmacy board here, so they authorized to sell this. Yeah. Yeah, so I know it's sure one, not fake. No fake. They're no fake.
Still, the World Health Organization says up to 30% of medicine consumed in Africa's poorest countries is actually counterfeit, made to look exactly like legitimate drugs. Same color, same shape, same packaging. Some phony malaria drugs are made from wheat flour or chalk. Others contain trace amounts of active ingredients. That's actually worse. It allows the malaria parasite to build up drug resistance. Dr. Edith Giramungu is head of the Medical Association of Tanzania.
If he or she cannot access the genuine drug, and he or she is severely ill with the malaria, then it means he or she may die.
The World Health Organization says 200,000 malaria deaths could have been prevented last year if all the drugs taken were genuine. Counterfeit drugs used to be a backyard business, but now they're made in industrial factories around the world, then imported at border crossings and shipping ports like this one in Dar es Salaam.
Those who supply them, they know that we need those drugs, and when supplying them, they supply in parallel with the genuine drugs.
John Mponella runs a federal anti-counterfeiting program. He says fake drugs are being shipped right alongside legitimate brand-name drugs. Somewhere along the line, counterfeiters slip the look-alike drugs into the same shipping containers, the same boxes. So by the time they arrive in Tanzania, no one can be sure they're getting the real thing.
I have been one of the victims because last time when I was suffering malaria, I had to take three types of drugs before I could get cured. And in the end of the day, I knew that I was taking fake drugs.
Healthcare workers and drug regulators have accused makers of fake drugs of, quote, mass murder. Again, Dr. Gira Mungu with the Medical Association of Tanzania.
I would advocate strongly for severe punishment to those dealing with counterfeit drugs. It's more of a human right issue.
Tanzanian officials say they're trying to crack down with bigger fines on those who sell counterfeit drugs. But Gira Mungu wants the government to identify loopholes that allow fake drugs to enter the country in the first place. She also wants the government to educate pharmacists and the general public to report any drug they find suspect. Gira Mungu says there may be an added consequence to fake malaria drugs.
So by having these counterfeit drugs, it may make people fearful for these conventional drugs and resort back to traditional drugs.
She says she's already seen evidence that some people are giving up on Western anti-malarial drugs and turning to folk medicine because, they say, they just can't trust if they're getting the real thing. For the World Vision Report, I'm Gretchen Wilson in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Writer Kelsey Timmerman had his own experience with malaria medication when he went on a trip to Honduras. Here's Kelsey's story.
My brother Kyle is sitting in a chair, thumbing through our Honduras guidebook. I'm swinging in a hammock. Between our vacation bungalow and the vast unmapped jungle flows the Rio Mocarón. It's likely that we're being bit by malaria-carrying mosquitoes as we speak, Kyle says, looking up from the section of the book covering tropical diseases. But it's amazing how much confidence a pill can give a fella. We both stare down at our arms and torsos, half expecting to see a superhero-like glow radiating. We think that we are faster than a speeding infected mosquito, our immune systems more powerful than locomotives, that we are able to leap wide mosquito-spawning rivers in a single bound. We are on drugs, specifically chloroquine, and are invincible. So we think. We return to our daily lives back home in Indiana, and while Kyle is studying for doctorate exams in exercise physiology, malaria parasites are staging a full-force siege on his immune system, despite his strict regimen of anti-malarial pills. Kyle writes off the occasional light fever, constant fatigue, and annoying headaches as a result of stressful hours of studying. Exams over, he hops a plane to France, where he is to attend a conference in, of all things, immunology. Shortly after Kyle arrives, he comes down with a fever of 106, shivers, aches, and vomiting. After 3 days in a hospital, his doctors, having eliminated a number of horrible deadly diseases, inform him via translator, "Good news, you've got malaria." Turns out that the strain of malaria that Kyle contracted can sometimes be resistant to chloroquine. So Kyle, a true man of the world, contracted malaria in Honduras, ignored the signs in Indiana, and was hospitalized with it in France. Kyle got malaria. I got guilt. After all, the trip to Honduras was my idea. After Kyle returns to Purdue, he relapses. Twice. My guilt grows by the relapse. When Kyle and I tell the story, the versions are somewhat different. Mine is about my failure to protect my big brother. His is about his success, protecting his little one. It goes something like this. My brother dragged me out to the Honduran jungle. A malaria-carrying mosquito was heading right for him. I pushed him out of the way and took the bite.
Kelsey Timmerman is a writer from Ohio. Drugs, bed nets, spraying, they're all critical parts of the campaign to end malaria. But none of these tools are of any use if people don't know why or how they should use them. In Mali, celebrities are using the stage and their status to fight malaria. Grant Fuller reports.
It's the third anniversary of the death of Ali Farka Touré, Mali's legendary king of the desert blues. In the courtyard of the Touré family home in Bamako, two young relatives play guitar. Others prepare to sacrifice a goat for a meal in honor of Ali Farka. For his son, Viu Farka Touré, they are big shoes to fill. And it doesn't stop with the music. Viu says his father was a big public health advocate, often giving medicine and lamps to rural hospitals. Now, like many other Malian artists, Viu Farka has picked up the fight against malaria.
What I can do is to help inform people, to make them understand certain things that they don't understand.
Things like the importance of eliminating stagnant water near the house and sleeping under a mosquito net. During his concerts, Viu takes time to talk about malaria in the local language. He speaks six of them. And he always carries a batch of insecticide-treated mosquito nets to give away. A full 10% of Viu Farka Touré's album sales is used to fund this personal anti-malaria effort. For him, as for his father, there's no choice but to spread the word.
If God gives you this opportunity, it's not only for you yourself. You need to share it with everybody. I am an artist, so it's an obligation. It's so simple like that.
In fact, a number of Malian musicians and actors have recently taken the lead on malaria education. One of the most famous is the singer Habib Kwate, who's currently on world tour.
Je suis un artiste qui aujourd'hui est connu dans son pays.
I'm an artist who's well known today in the country, Kwate says, and my popularity allows me to mobilize a certain audience who will listen to what I have to say. In this public service announcement, Kwate says, if I get malaria, I can't sing, and if you get malaria, you won't be able to do your job either. It may be surprising that such a simple message is necessary for people who live with malaria as an everyday fact of life. But many still don't know the basics about the disease, so these ads try to get them to understand the serious threat malaria poses and convince them to do their part, along with government, to fight it. Habib Kwate filmed his TV spot for the organization Voix du Mali, or Voices of Mali. Umar Qureshi is a spokesperson for the organization. He says Voix du Mali aims to pressure the government.
Deuxièmement, c'est donc le contenu des messages.
The most important message is to have medication for children. The malaria drugs for children up to age 5 is free, but sometimes there's a shortage. And we also appeal for insecticide-treated mosquito nets for everybody.
And the Malian government is paying attention. It recently responded to pressure from Voix du Mali and others, making changes to the National Malaria Control Program that gave the office greater influence. And while the government currently provides free nets only for pregnant women and babies, a universal free net distribution program will start in 2010. Last year, Voix du Mali brought a dozen singers together to produce this anti-malaria song. It's called La Dilikan, which means advice. The lyrics, in six different languages spoken in Mali, urge everyone to use a mosquito net to protect themselves and their children from the disease. And even puppets are getting in on the act. This performance features traditional wooden puppets from Mali's Bambara ethnic group. Tebu Bagayoko is the man behind the puppet voices. He's a member of the internationally known Sogolone puppet troupe and uses his art to teach malaria lessons like this in villages across the country. Actually, it wasn't long ago that he himself learned the facts about malaria.
Certains membres de ma famille qui ont perdu la vie à cause de cette maladie. Donc du coup parce que moi-même du coup au départ moi-même j'ai pas compris.
I have lost some members of my family because of this sickness. I didn't understand the issue at the time, but from advertisements on TV and on the radio, I saw that I can be involved in fighting against it because I know that people are interested in seeing my puppet show.
When he takes his anti-malaria show on the road, Bagayoko partners with the well-known singer Aminata Traore. They say entire villages will crowd around to see the puppets and hear Aminata sing against the disease. Traore knows as well as anyone that malaria is no joke.
I lost my husband from the disease 4 years ago. When he passed away, I was pregnant, and that baby also got malaria. My baby girl passed away when she was 6 days old.
In our interview, it took Aminata just a few moments to compose this anti-malaria song and sing it on the spot. She warns of the trap malaria creates when you let it take over your life. All that we have now is malaria, the song says. This sickness is the only thing holding me back. When we let malaria in, there is nowhere to go. Her eyes close as she sings, and in this moment, Aminata seems to bear the collective passion of so many performers against malaria. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Bamako, Mali.
And that brings us to the end of our malaria special. As you've heard, there's exciting news in the fight against the disease. It'll take a concerted effort involving every tool possible. But everyone's hoping this is one disease getting much closer to being conquered. We have a special page on malaria on our website with extended interviews, videos, photos, and more. It's at worldvisionreport.org. And of course, you can download a podcast there, too. This program was produced by Beverly Abel and Cynthia Graber. It was edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.